Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. As we head into hour two, it is a delight, honor, privilege, and every other good thing to welcome into the studio one of my dearest friends and one of our greatest and most sincere activists for good things in our community, Ann Atkinson, former executive director of the T.W. Lewis Center at ASU, and now someone I refer to as Xena, the Princess Warrior for Free Speech, or Xena, the Free Speech Princess Warrior. Good to see you, Anne. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, my friend. It's great to be here with you.
You betcha. Sometimes running partner, too.
Often.
Anne is training to... Can I tell them what you're training to do?
Sure thing.
She's training to swim with sharks. That's what you're training to do.
In 4 weeks.
Yeah.
With four species of sharks.
Four species of sharks from Alcatraz.
From Alcatraz Island in San Francisco.
You've done it once before.
I did it last year, and it's the Escape from Alcatraz Triathlon, where we swim from Alcatraz to basically the base of the Golden Gate Bridge, and then we bike, and then we run, and then we enjoy the sourdough bread bowls from the Boudin Bakery with clam chowder and unlimited
libations. I may have to go and watch this. I may have to go and observe somehow, figure it out. But the sharks will know you from last year then, like Androcles and the lion. They'll leave you alone. They'll say she's safe.
They're friendly, and there are a lot, you know, you go back to the three billy goats clip-clopping over the bridge,
yeah.
The child's story, and yeah. There's a more attractive billy goat than me, so be good.
Well, to quote Jimmy Buffett, let's talk about the sharks that live on the land. Let's talk about our college campuses. That's what I wanted to talk to you about. If this were a firing line episode, Bill Buckley might title it, "What's Wrong with Our College Campuses?" You know the college campuses well. You've spent your professional career on, in, and around them, and with students, and with sororities and fraternities. And we're looking at something under a hood here we didn't know existed, much like a lot of people were looking under a hood in 2020 and 2021 that they didn't know existed at the elementary and secondary level. What the H is going on?
Well, I will say, I'll start with this. I spent the last week attending graduations and listening to speeches and attending graduation dinners and seeing a lot of these students that I've had the pleasure of getting to know over the past several years. And this is one of the most inspirational, intelligent, ambitious generations that we've had. This cohort coming through, if they're allowed to be their best selves, despite what we'll talk about today, there is great news ahead. There are good things on the horizon. But when I think about what is the greatest issue plaguing this generation, it's coddling. Mm-hmm. It is simply coddling. The actions of the adults in the room, they're coddling these students, and they have their whole lives. You think about the theme of coddling. These students have been coddled since they were little, and they needed to wear a helmet and elbow pads and knee pads. They need to be overprotected in a way that really kids hadn't been in generations before. And when they had an issue with mental health, they're sent straight into therapy. So the foundation I see, and really a theme for what I think we'll talk about, is how these students really in all ways have been coddling, and the adults are making their issues much worse.
Adam Carolla testified to Congress a few years back when he was doing the No Safe Spaces stuff with Dennis Prager. And he talked about kids need gravity, because if you don't have gravity, you lose muscle mass. In zero gravity environments like astronauts, you lose muscle mass and you lose moral mass and you lose strength in all the important areas. And we're not giving these kids gravity. We're not giving them consequences. We're not teaching them yes and no. We're not teaching them wins and losses. We're putting them in front of a TV for hours on end where they watch Wow Wow Wubsy and everyone's fine and everyone's great. Fair enough?
Fair enough. And we're doing that. Putting them in front of a TV watching Wow Wow Wubsy when they're 19, 20, 21 years old as college students.
Yeah.
So when I was running the T.W. Lewis Center for Personal Development at Barrett, the Honors College, we hosted real life programs with real world speakers. And they would ask me, how should I dress? And I say, come as you are. How should I speak? Speak as you do. Should I watch my language? I said, bring the real world to these students. And in the absence of the Lewis Center, what I see in terms of programming, not just at Barrett, the Honors College, but other higher education institutions, there are therapy dogs, there are clay pottery painting, pronoun pin decorating, safe spaces for these students. And they're really treated like they're incapable of facing this real world. these are adults. They're capable. They're ready. And we treat them like infants, even when they're, you know, ready to embark on that real world.
Interestingly enough, the place where they should be exposed to the most ideas is the thing that we're protecting them most from, seems to me. You want to protect young adults or any adult or any kid from a physical danger or from harm or from crime and criminal elements. The university used to be about a place of ideas, and that's the thing we seem to be most sedulous about wanting to protect them from, or that they need protection from. Yeah? Isn't that an irony?
And the university is hiring these activists, so many, that are taking the position of telling the students what is harmful and what is not. Mm-hmm. And you look at, you know, Dennis Prager and Charlie Kirk, and they're treated like these, you know, these harmful bigots that are threats to the, you know, democracy, as these faculty have labeled them. And then real threats are treated much, much differently. So you have these people that not only coddle the students, but then they try to protect them from what they deem to be harmful. And what this does is it creates a generation of followers. These students that I know, they're not intended to be followers. They're strong, they're smart, they're capable. But this system that we have is training these students to follow the order, to follow the belief about what is good, what is evil, what should be permissible, and to follow the direction when they're told that they need help. Here's a funny moment just for your listeners, that of all these pro-Hamas encampments on college campuses today, there is now going to be an event next week hosted by Students for Justice in Palestine that provides counselors and therapy to the students at these encampments because they're taught that they need to be coddled, they need to be safe. And this is marketed as therapy, as a safe space only for those in the encampment.
And SJP is providing that?
Students for Justice in Palestine.
You know, that's so interesting because it is a movement on behalf of whom there is no self-doubt or self-questioning in this terrorist element that works across the Middle East or that they're marching for in Hamas. So interesting. I'm glad you reminded me that it was Prager and Kirk that offended so many of these students and professors as such a threat to their being, while we can see these same students and same professors marching for an organization that tortures children and kills LGBTQ.
Exactly. They're, and it's interesting how many people are seeing our students as a means to those ends.
Yeah.
Right? These people, these groups, the large activists behind the encampment, the students are not leading these encampments. They're funded, they're organized, they're put together by outside groups, but the students are increasingly seen as a means to an end.
Mm-hmm.
Even on social media, they're seen as somebody that can buy a product, mm-hmm. right? They're seen as a dollar sign.
Mm-hmm.
In these instances, the activists on our college campuses are seeing students as simply a means to an end.
This is a sign of a sick society, and we did this during COVID at a different level, but it's something I've noticed increasingly, that adults are using children to soothe their own anxieties and to solve their own workout, their own psychoses. You know, there's that old expression from the French Revolution, every revolution ends up devouring its own. But the full quote is, like Saturn, every revolution devours its own. Like Saturn. Saturn was the Roman god who ate his children because he was afraid of them. And it seems adults are using these children, as terrorist organizations do. They use children for minesweepers. They use children for suicide bombing missions. They use, you know, the use and abuse of children is, it seems to me, sign of a sick society. And that, too, is what's going on here, isn't it?
And they're using these children or young adults that are in college campuses that don't need to have opinions on all the issues of the world, right? It is okay in the year 2024 for any person simply not to have an opinion on something.
Yeah.
And here, imagine these students new to adulthood. They're taught that they are supposed to opine on everything and also be on the side that opposes hate.
Yeah.
And gosh, I mean, that is what a way to use the students, to use them and abuse them, to take their one of their greatest weaknesses, which is this feeling like they have to have an opinion on everything, and to use it, to use them as pawns for that greater good of, you know, as they say.
It's an interesting thing. I want to do two things. We have a commercial break in when we come back. One is, you brought a book with you. I don't know what it is, but I'm always interested when someone brings a book because you and I love books. So I want to see what you want to share with the audience in the book that you brought. But I want to ask you about happiness and sadness too with these youth, because you taught me when you were showing me some of the videos of some of these kids, you said, look into their eyes and what do you see? And I said, there's a sadness there. And you go, exactly. Can we talk about that when we come back? Ann Atkinson is my guest. She and I will be right back. Excited to have one of my favorite people in the whole wide world, Ann Atkinson, in studio with us. The topic was, what's wrong with our college students? What's wrong with our colleges? And over the break, Ann was saying, are we doing too much? Do we need to, like, hone in on an aspect of this? And I think what I want to do, Ann, is say no to both and invite you back for 3 hours next time you have some time, because on this issue, because there is so much here and it'll give us that. But I did want to get your thoughts on this. As I've been watching what's going on our campuses over the last few weeks, I really did want to get your views on these things. Before we turn to the book you brought, speak to me a little bit about sadness, if you don't mind. You see some of these students. Yeah, there's angerness. Yes, there's anger. Yes, there's bitterness. But you taught me to see in their eyes a real sadness of their soul, too. Is it that they're thirsting for something and they don't know what it is because they haven't been taught what the good stuff is, but they want something strong? So, well, here's a terrorist movement. That's something strong. I can follow that. I mean, they do have pulls. Gangs have pulls on young kids, as do the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts, right?
The students here, the happy students, the sad students, the freshmen, the seniors, consistently they feel an insane amount of pressure to be and do something, right? They're constantly seeing examples of another student who just graduated with, you know, three majors on, who was the outstanding graduating senior. They're seeing examples on social media of people posting about their fake lives, right? The students today, young people, Now, fortunately, unfortunately, college students today have been on social media longer than what probably those of us who've seen the effects think is healthy.
Yeah.
And the pressure that they're feeling, they are incredibly lonely.
Yeah.
They feel like they see the highlights of other people's lives and that they just will never measure up. They can never do enough. They can never be enough. I remember one of my favorite students from Barrett told me that she wants to be Forbes 30 under 30.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, why?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I just do. I need to do something significant.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what do you want to do to earn a spot on Forbes 30 under 30? I don't know, but I just know I need to be there.
Mm-hmm.
Who says you need to be Forbes 30 under 30?
Mm-hmm.
What does that even mean? Look, I've had, as you know, Seth, I've had a 20-year career in healthcare, real estate, investments. I've done a lot of the ego things. I rang the closing bell in the New York Stock Exchange. I've, you know, flown on the fancy planes. None of that matters. None of that makes you happy. None of that matters at the end of the day. No one will talk about that at your funeral, but yet these students are feeling this incredible pressure from all that they see. It's not just social media. It's access to instant information. It's the expectation that they need to be all and then some. And no matter what they accomplish, no matter who they are, there's a sadness. And the only thing I have seen that's allowed those students to overcome that sadness is true one-on-one time or time in a community like what we had at the Lewis Center, just to be with others,
mm-hmm.
to not see a projection of a fake life, but just to be in the company of others.
Yeah, that's itself a challenge to the university system right now. I don't know if they want you happy. I don't know if the university generally wants you happy, or at least not in the social sciences. When you think about particularly in the poli-sci or IR, international relations departments, they want you to think the world is a miserable place. So much easier to join a Marxist revolution, I would think. You wouldn't join a revolutionary movement if things were great.
And
I think they want you to see dark.
And providing a safe, comfortable
right.
place
yeah.
allows people to feel a fake sense of loyalty.
Yeah,
right. To feel
right.
like they're safe here, they're welcome, they have their therapy, they have their, you know, whatever certain events I mentioned a few earlier today make them feel good, but that's a way to kind of buy loyalty.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Tell me about the book you brought.
Well, we were talking about, you asked me to talk today about what's wrong with our college students, and I happen to just love this generation and see the unique issues that they're facing, but I came back to a book, one of my favorite books from the last couple years. It's Greg Lukianoff and Jonathan Haidt, and it's The Coddling of the American Mind, how good intentions and bad ideas are setting up a generation for failure. And the point I wanted to address in this book, they have a chapter. I'm going to read the title and then one quote from this. It's the untruth of us versus them. Life is a battle between good people and evil people. And I'm going to tie this back to the issue in higher education. Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks in Not in God's Name said, "There is the moral dualism that sees good and evil as instincts within us between which we must choose. But there is also what I would call pathological dualism that sees humanity itself as radically divided into the unimpeachably good and the irredeemably bad. You are either one or the other." Mm. This is what I see on our college campuses. This is my personal experience of mostly professors and faculty painting this binary world for the students that you are either unimpeachably good mm-hmm. or irredeemably bad. And as such, you must not only label everything as one of those two categories, but you also, as a student, must look to the arbiters to tell you what is good or mm-hmm. what is bad. And I think that is why the faculty came out so hard on Dennis Prager, saying he's a threat to the democracy, and why, when I look at so many other examples of what's happened on college campuses, things just are let fly, mm-hmm. right? Because this binary world, the students are picking a side, many of the faculty are picking a side, and most of the administrations have lost control of those groups.
When we were growing up, I'm guessing you're a bit younger than I, but when we were growing up, I think in the sense of a different kind of generation than today, we never heard the words racism. We never heard the words, or very rarely, or white nationalist or fascist. Those were exceptionally special words for exceptional situations. And now those words just saturate campuses and saturate political discussion. And I wonder if it's part and parcel of this that Lukianoff and Haidt are writing about. We have to go to these extremes and see everyone in a binary that way. And the binary of, if you don't agree with me, is fascist, racist, nationalist, white
nationalist. And it's the binary of the oppressor versus the oppressed,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
When I look at these honors faculty who are siding with Hamas, mm-hmm. why are they doing that? Their approach has been about, you know, Israel. They're colonizing basically Hamas and Palestine, and it is Israel is the oppressor, and everyone else, the Palestinians, so they say, are the oppressed. Mm-hmm. And I think there are themes of the oppressor versus the oppressed in every level of higher ed today. The pro Hamas encampments might be one example of that, but that is the binary lens, and things are complicated. The world is not binary; it doesn't fit into, you know, black and white typically. Now, there are two genders, male and female, period, the end. But most issues are complicated and not this oppressor versus oppressed, black and white, that we're seeing from these professors.
Such an interesting angle to this that we didn't have time to delve into today. But will you come back for 3 hours? Because I would like to pursue a lot of these things, including why so many women are at the vanguard of these rallies. That's an interesting thing. Heather MacDonald had a recent essay that goes into some of that. That's a curiosity. But also the professional areas of these professors who are leading these charges on campus and the disciplines they come from. Also interesting. Anne Atkinson, thank you. Will you come back for 3 hours?
I will. I'd be happy to.
All right. Send me your schedule or send it to David and we'll work it out. I'm Seth Leibson. George Kaloff coming right up. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Delight to bring back our dear friend George Kaloff. He is, among other things, the president of Data Orbital and the managing partner at the Resolute Group, political consultant, election expert. George, welcome back. Happy Friday. Thanks for being with us.
Happy Friday to you, Seth. Always good to be on.
Thanks. Under Data Orbital, you just released a poll this past week, the headline of which is something we should all be a little nervous about, I think. Democrats hold slight edge. Tell us what you polled. Tell us what you found.
Yeah, so we released a survey of likely general election voters, so who we expect to vote in Arizona in the 2024 general election on November 5th, on the presidential and the U.S. Senate races. And we found a slight edge. And I will say it was a fraction of a percent, so well within the margin of error on the presidential race, and about a 4% advantage. So a fraction of a percent advantage to current President Joe Biden over former President Donald Trump, and about a 4% advantage for Congressman Ruben Gallego over Carrie Lake. And even though we know Carrie Lake has a primary, we just tested her and not her primary opponent, Sheriff Mark Lamb. And so right now we do have Democrats with a slight edge with a little under 6 months left to go until the election.
Interesting. Now, if you were a political consultant for either of these campaigns, Biden, Trump, Gallego, Lake, you wouldn't take any of this to the bank, right? I mean, within a margin of error means we are, what, neck and neck, or right?
We are. We are. And again, I mean, 0.8, 0.7% actually technically, it really is a statistical tie. Still 6 months to the election.
Yeah.
We know, and it makes sense, you know, it shouldn't be surprising that Carrie Lake is running behind former President Donald Trump. A lot of time left in the election. The polling numbers in general look better for former President Donald Trump everywhere in the nation. That is the consistent theme, even though the media is trying to downplay that. So around this time, a couple years ago, or I shouldn't say a couple, 4 years ago, we had, at that point, current President Trump down a bit larger than this. I mean, we had him down in the high single digits at one point throughout the campaign during the height of COVID. And so I'm not surprised by this, and I don't view this as particularly negative for President Trump, or definitely not positive for President Biden.
You know, I have a much quicker temper than you. You're a much calmer person than I am. But one of the things that really gets my ire up, my Irish up, George, is when someone says about an inevitable candidate, a Trump, a Lake, someone says, well, they just can't possibly win. There's no chance they can win. It's nonsense. It's nonsense. And your poll is proof of that, right? Of course they can win. And of course they're within the reach of winning. Yes.
100%, both of them. And candidly, former President Trump, almost everywhere in every swing state, he's doing very well, exceeding his numbers from last time. And this isn't just because of a poll here or there that has him up bigger with, let's say, young African-American men. There's a broader body of work that is showing this consistently. Ironically, we're one of the first surveys in Arizona to show President Biden up against former President Trump. And so the trend lines and the general data is very good for the former president. And I will say it's because of this one question. If the average Arizonan and the average American asks themselves, is my life better today than it was 4 years ago? If the answer is yes, easy vote for Joe Biden. If the answer is no, easy vote for Donald Trump, right? And I think instinctually, it's hard to find. Do you really think we're going to find a majority of Arizonans or a majority of Americans in the swing states to answer affirmatively to that question, that my life is better today? I think that's a stretch for the average American, and definitely for the average Arizonan.
Is that the most potent question? I can't think of a more potent question to ask in an election of such a dynamic. Is there a more important question than that? That's got to be the most important question, right? Or at least among them.
I mean, other than tracking the ballot test, right? Other than tracking the head-to-head, who would you vote for, this person or this person?
Yeah.
I do think it is the most potent, because that also allows us to cut through the noise of the third party. So a dynamic that we didn't talk about is, what does, you know, Robert F. Kennedy's numbers, I think, were way larger in this survey than what I'm going to expect him to be on election day. I mean, he polled almost 15%.
Let me take a quick break and talk to you about that when we come back. And then I want to talk to you about African-American voters, Jewish voters, and your sense of whether we are going to see some tectonic shifts or even marginal shifts that might make a tectonic difference. George Kaloff is my guest. He and I will be right back.
I think when you make that decision, it might be well if you would ask yourself, are you better off than you were 4 years ago?
Yeah, and that's what clinched it in 1980 for Ronald Reagan. George Kaloff is my guest. We were just talking about the poignancy of that question. Works a little better, obviously, running for president than two non-incumbents running against each other as in the Senate. Right, George?
Yes. It absolutely does. That's why I think the dynamic of the Senate race is a lot more complicated than the dynamics of the presidential race. But look, those words really are immortal words. They were true 45 years ago, almost 45 years ago. They're definitely true today.
Yep.
Seth, this is something you and I have talked about consistently. We have never been as far apart as we have been as a nation on critical and key issues. Not one, not two, almost everything. And there are very pointed differences, both domestically for sure and internationally. And I think that question is going to be the question of the day. is my life better today than it was 4 years ago? It's always more difficult for an incumbent president when things are not going well.
Sure.
And things are very precarious in the nation today.
Sure. But what Ronald Reagan could answer that in the positive in 1984, after 4 years, he could say your life is better than it was 4 years ago. And what we have here, and obviously that translated into a 49-state win in 1984. But what we have here is something kind of unique in politics, it seems to me, George. We have a controlled experiment. We had 4 years of Trump, and we had 4 years of Biden to measure it against. It's not just a question in the vacuum of was it better 4 years ago. It's was it better 4 years ago when I was president versus 4 years ago when the last 4 years as you've been president. And I don't know a single indicia, a single index where things are better than they were 4 years. Not one, not on the economy, not on the border, not on foreign relations, not on war and peace. You name it, not one. Now, maybe I'm missing something, but what astounds me is that this is a close race still. But what it tells me, it's what you said. We are just a very divided country. Some people look at this and either don't care or think that, what? The Republican brand is so tainted and tarnished that they just can't bring themselves to see it? Gets me to answer that any way you want or seg it into any way you want with, does that leave RFK Jr. there to pick up some of that? I don't know.
So as you were talking, I thought of another question I think helps answer some of this, which has to do with what the former Secretary of State of Georgia, Brad, I forget his last name. It's a complicated way. Is it Rasberger or something like that?
Yeah,
that obviously went toe-to-toe with former President Trump. You know, I could say, you know, in technical terms, hates his guts, right? There's no love there between the two of them.
Right.
And he says, I'm a Republican. Even if we agree on 100% of issues, I'm not going to vote for someone who's destroyed our democracy,
right?
So maybe the second question is, do you believe that former President Donald Trump is a threat to democracy or some variation of that?
Yeah.
Because even if I suppose the answer to the first question is yes, maybe the first question is no, my life is not better today than 4 years ago, that the answer to the second question is yes, I do believe he's a threat to democracy. There may be some individuals that are willing to vote that way. I think that those are individuals that are going to be highly educated and in suburbs and probably are hindered by the economy, but are not, absolutely set back by it. Probably different calculation for someone whose day-to-day life is dramatically difficult because of the current policies and where we are today. So that's where sort of it gets to the RFK question even, is that right now in Arizona, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is technically pulling slightly more from former President Trump than from Joe Biden, or in best case neutral, which is very surprising since he's been a Democrat most of his life and holds, other than on medical freedom issues and COVID, holds almost ubiquitous views with the Democratic Party. That is a harm, but I'm not convinced the third party candidate's going to get anywhere near double digits when it's all said and done consistently in surveys, other than in the Ross Perot years. Third party candidates poll much better than they actually do when it comes down time to election day. A lot of those voters just don't vote.
I wonder,
or they end up picking one of the other two.
I wonder, George, if you could see a potential where Robert Kennedy Jr. picks up and gets into double digits with disaffected Jewish Democrats. Because, he holds all the liberal views, as you point out, but he's extremely strong on Israel. He may be the most strong candidate on Israel that's ever run for president, to be honest with you, aside from his dad, maybe. It's kind of an interesting dynamic. And it seems for all these Democrats who are saying they can't stand Joe Biden on the Israel question, the Israel-Gaza question, they can't vote for a Republican because they're constitutionally incapable of doing it. Maybe a Robert Kennedy in certain states may mean something for them. Maybe. I don't know. It's a thought.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it depends on the state. I don't know if that population is large enough in the state of Arizona to affect. I think in other states it may be, but that's a factor. The Muslim Democratic vote's a factor, potentially, in places like Michigan, right? What do they do? And I can't remember off the top of my head if RFK made it onto the ballot there or they vote uncommitted. So that's why this race is every race is it's a toss-up and it's very precarious. This one's even way more complicated, arguably, than during the COVID years because there's so many polar opposite dynamics. It's like a game of tug of war for folks that remember playing that, and someone gets the advantage and the other person gets the advantage. I really believe it's going to come down to the wire with a lot of these voters that are either haven't made up their mind on who to vote for, or more importantly, arguably, could be haven't made up their mind on if they are going to vote.
Yeah.
That may be the big difference, is who votes. All these polls are only as good as who we predict votes on election day. If it's dramatically different who ends up voting, it will have an effect, obviously, on the final results. I think that may be one of the other very important questions for political commentators and observers to track.
Isn't that so interesting in a way that we're so politicized as a society now? And I think you'd agree with me, we're probably more politicized than we've ever been. Everything is political and everyone has a very strong political opinion, that we might actually see, even though we're so politicized, we may see a dynamic of people not voting. That's kind of an irony, yeah. Right?
I know, because of how political we are. Yeah, we're in an age of probably extreme political irony on a day to day, week by week basis.
Is the black vote, the African American vote for Trump, a big deal?
It is, because even a 5 or 10% difference in that young African American vote among men is a big deal in a state like Pennsylvania, in a state like Michigan. Again, keep in mind the states where it matters.
Yeah.
It will then solidify places like Ohio, of course. But if Michigan and Pennsylvania come back to the side of the ledger for former President Trump, it's going to be very difficult. The path to victory for President Biden is going to be close to impossible, because it would then require him to win much larger states like Florida, which is not going to happen, or Texas, which I don't think is on the radar. Even if somehow former President Biden wins Arizona, which I think is very precarious at best, right? I mean, I would say former President Trump is in a much better position than President Biden is today to win the state, even with the polling numbers the way that they were, with it being a pure toss-up.
Well done,
sir. It is going to be effective.
Yeah, well done. All right. Well, thank you for calling in, George. I really appreciate it. I really appreciate all the work you do, and it's a delight having you on and talking through these things with you. Next time you're on, I want to talk to you a little bit about how foreign policy does play in an election, because it usually doesn't have that much of a significance, right? And I want to think about whether it might be a little bit different this time. There's a few elections.
Yeah, this year maybe.
Yeah. 1980 maybe 2004. Yeah. Maybe this one.
Yeah.
We'll do that when you come back next time. George Kaloff, thank you very much, sir.
We'll talk soon.
You betcha. I'm Seth Leibson. Be right back. Portions of the show brought to you by our good friends at YRefi. YRefi offers a secure investment in a collateralized portfolio that actually helps people and you. You can earn up to a 10.25% fixed rate of return with YRefi, and it's not correlated to the stock market or the Federal Reserve, and it comes with a lot of flexibility for you. With YRefi, there are absolutely no fees. With YRefi, you can compound your income, you can turn it on, you can turn it off, whatever you like. With YRefi, you have peace of mind. There is no attack on principal if you ever need your money back. Of course, you get a monthly statement with no surprises. Check them out at investyrefi.com. That's invest, the letter Y, then refy.com, or give them a call at 888-YRefi-24. Thinking about that conversation with George and how politicized we are, that there is an irony that the people may not vote at all. But 1968, the year David Dahl keeps wanting me to go back to, as a template for this election, what about the people who aren't exercised politically, who may show up to vote? This is what Richard Nixon was talking about in 1968. Hit it, Maestro.
Listen to the answer to those questions. It is another voice. It is a quiet voice in the tumult of the shouting. It is the voice of the great majority of Americans, the forgotten Americans, the non-shouters, the non-demonstrators. They're not racist or sick. They're not guilty of the crime that plagues the land. They are black, they're white. They're native-born and foreign-born. They're young and they're old. They work in America's factories. They run America's businesses. They serve in government. They provide most of the soldiers who died to keep us free. They give drive to the spirit of America. They give lift to the American dream. They give steel to the backbone of America. They're good people. They're decent people. They work and they save and they pay their taxes and they care. Like Theodore Roosevelt, they know that this country will not be a good place for any of us to live in unless it's a good place for all of us to live in. This I say, this I say to you tonight, is the real voice of America. In this year, 1968, this is the message it will broadcast to America and to the world. Let's never forget that despite her faults, America is a great nation. And America is great because her people are great. With Winston Churchill, we say, we have not journeyed all this way, across the centuries, across the oceans, across the mountains, across the prairies, because we are made of sugar candy.
Hold it right there, young David, if you don't mind. Hold it right there. And that's the point I'm trying to make here. Will a lot of Americans vote for something else other than Joe Biden because they're tired of their country being run down? And will that, these quiet Americans we haven't heard from, be the roar that we see in November? I think possibly. We'll be right back.